Hello, and welcome to Small World, Big Problems. This is a podcast from the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. My name is Eli George, and I'll be your host for today. Now, what you're about to hear is part one of a two-part interview that I did with Richard T. Bew, who also goes by his call sign Otter. Otter is currently the chief of staff for Lockheed Martin, but he's had lots of other roles in the past, and we talk about lots of interesting things in this interview, such as his time as a Marine aviator, the importance of human capital in the civil-military relationship, and the changing character of war. But we actually didn't get to everything that we wanted to talk about, and so afterwards, Otter reached back out to me and said, "Hey, if you're up for round two, so am I," and I of course said yes. And so you'll hear that second interview next week. But for now, sit back and enjoy the show. Today, our guest is someone that I'm really excited about, Richard T. Bew, or Otter, as he's known to most. Otter is currently the chief of staff at Lockheed Martin, a company that he joined in 2019. This comes after almost three decades as a pilot in the U.S. Marine Corps, during which time he flew combat missions in Bosnia, Serbia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. During his final tour in the Marines, he also served as the legislative assistant to the Joint Chiefs. So, Otter, welcome to the show.
Eli, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Now, I want to start off with your call sign, Otter, O-T-T-E-R, because everyone I know who knows you calls you that, and the question has been living rent-free in my head for months now. So where does that come from?
First, I'll tell you that normally when people ask me that question, I lie and make up a story, but it goes back to my first combat deployment in 1994. We're living in tents off the end of a runway in Aviano, Italy. We didn't have any entertainment. And so somebody had pulled out of a dumpster a combination TV VCR, and in there was a tape. And it was the movie Animal House, but it was in Italian. And so we sat around watching this movie. And at some point, somebody said, "Otter, there's a character in the movie. That's you." But don't tell my wife. I've told her it's because, I'm a good swimmer and crack abalone on my chest in the water.
That is a good story, and that sounds like a long time to be stuck with just Animal House to watch. So you were in the Marines for 30 years, and you were a pilot, and I think sometimes people forget that there are aviators in the Marines and the Army and the Navy, not just the Air Force. But I'm curious, what kind of set you down that path? What led you to be interested in being a Marine, and more specifically being a pilot?
Yeah, I think how people are drawn to serve, it's just such a wide range of stories. For me, it was, I had no intention of going into the military. I was at Lehigh University. I think it was towards the end of my freshman year. I was walking through our university center, just crowded, middle of the day kind of thing. And there was a guy, in retrospect now, a Marine officer in dress blues. Hmm. And I'm standing in the crowd. And by the way, I'm not very tall. I'm 5'6". And so most folks are like crowding me out there. Mm-hmm. But he looked through the crowd and he pointed at me. And then he beckoned me with his finger. And I came over and a little bit put off by this, "Why is this guy calling me over here all dressed up in these dress blues in the middle of our university center?" And he said, "Do you want to fly jets for the Marine Corps?" And I said, "Yeah, sure. That sounds pretty neat." But I was a little put off by it. And he said, "What are you doing this afternoon?" I said, "I have class." And he said, "Can you skip it?" Now I'm really a little bit weirded out because I'm like, why is this guy pulling me out of the crowd? Long story short, I went and did what was called the flight indoctrination program. I went down to the airport and I met an aviator, Marine aviator. Mm-hmm. He took me up in the airplane for about 45 minutes. What he was doing was seeing if I had any sort of aeronautical adaptability whatsoever. I came back and I fell in love with it. Fast forward a couple of years, I'm become an officer. I'd gone to flight school. I'd earned my wings, and I ran into my recruiter.
Oh, really?
The guy who waved to me at the university center that day. And I asked him, I said, "I've always wondered why it was that you looked through the crowd and you beckoned me over there." He said, "A couple reasons. Number one, you didn't wear glasses." We needed perfect vision. I assumed, okay, this is best bet. Number two, you're physically fit. You look cocky, what we're looking for. And he said, "But most importantly, you were an easy mark. You looked like somebody who would be easy to recruit because you had an ego about you. And I was going to sell you on the fact that the Marine Corps could make you your best self. And I thought, yep, that worked.
Yeah.
29 and a half, 30 years later, I look back on that and, you know, Marine Corps recruiters do a good job, but he had it right. I wanted to be part of something bigger than myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Do you remember what the class that you skipped was?
I don't. I actually wasn't the best student there. Years later, when I went to SICE, I think hopefully I'd improved by that point. But no, I don't recall.
In the end, it all seemed to work out. Oh, and I did forget to mention in your bio that you are a SICE alum as well, that you are a student here at SICE.
Yeah, and as you and I have spoken about before, one of the reasons I was really happy to say yes to this opportunity here is I think incredibly highly of SICE as an institution, the people there individually, and the professors I've had the chance to learn from and maintain relationships with through today.
Yeah, I think everyone is appreciative to hear you say that. I want to maybe talk a little bit more about your experience as a pilot, because thinking back, I believe you are the first pilot that we've interviewed on the show. And obviously there's the perception that we get in Top Gun and similar movies, but what is, from your perspective, the experience of flying? What are the sensations, the sights, the smells, the sounds? What's going through your head when you get called for a combat mission? What is that whole experience like from a personal perspective?
Yeah. First, I'd say that the experience as a Marine aviator, I don't think the first thing I think about is actually flying the airplane. Mm-hmm. You know, so much of it is about the community that you're a part of, being in a flight line, a gun squadron, being on the flight line, being in the ready room, these folks that you're with, you come and join them. You get welcomed in with all the pluses and minuses of the rituals of being joined into a squadron, to include being given a call sign. And then you spend all of your time with them. There's not a lot of aviators in a flight line gun squadron that have a lot of hobbies. Your days, your nights, your weekends are all committed to being the best aviator you can. And you're doing that around these people. And so the first thing I think about is actually the squadron mm-hmm. itself and being in the ready room. Mm-hmm. When it comes to flying the jet, I think what you think about, what's going through your head, it changes over time. When you first get to the squadron, you're just trying to be your best tactical self, which is being a good wingman. And eventually being a good section lead, where you're taking responsibility for someone who's flying on your wing, to potentially being an instructor for advanced systems in the aircraft, whether that's night systems or new weapon systems. And then how you look at the combat missions changes over time, because your first combat mission might be going through your head, I just want to be on time. I want to be on target. I want to make sure I've done everything right. Fast forward 5-10 years, where you've got 2-3 combat deployments under your belt. And what you're thinking about is, I've got 3 wingmen out there because I'm a division lead. I'm the SEAD lead for a 25 plane suppression of air defense mission mm-hmm. that has to succeed. Otherwise, we're going to lose strikers coming across the target in 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And you're listening to 3 different radios at the same time. You're trying to make sure you're keeping aware of everybody's gas in the air, that if there are exceptions to people's jet status, so we call it gadget bent. If radar's not working or something like that, or one of their stations is not going to be usable, you're trying to think about how that's going to impact the mission. So my point is, it evolves, like any profession, significantly over time, from a first combat tour in the squadron to now you're a squadron commander and you've got 180 people, 6 aircraft, and you're living in a fenced off compound in Al Asad, Iraq. Those are mm-hmm. just really different things.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense, and especially makes sense spending 29 years doing that, that your perspective changes over time. And what I find interesting is that those 29 years in the Marines were very tumultuous 29 years as far as American foreign policy and global geopolitics goes. When I'm thinking, you know, events like 9/11 and the start of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Earlier than that, in the 90s, there was the breakup of Yugoslavia. And then even later on, you have things like the Russian invasion of Crimea in 2014. Did you see, because of events like that, or because of the changing nature of global politics, did your experience on the ground, or I guess maybe I should say in the air, did that influence your experience, things that were happening outside of, you know, the immediate mission that you were working on?
Yeah, Eli, that's some ways I've been privileged to serve during this period of American history. You mentioned several conflicts. I'll hit on a couple of them there that mm-hmm. I served in. You know, as you develop as an aviator, I think the way you look at the conflicts you're in changes. But I'll highlight one thing that I think is also relevant for the non-military but policy-oriented crowd. Mm-hmm. Of the conflicts that you mentioned, the one that stands out to me, it's not decades in Iraq or Afghanistan. It's one that most people forget to mention. For example, Allied Force, which was in Serbia, mm-hmm. Yugoslavia. As an aviator, most of the missions that I flew, I had strategic advantage, relative impunity, right? We, for most of these conflicts, have owned the air. One of the things I think is instructive, and it's part of that growth as, I think, a military expert, about the Allied Force experience was there was a significant threat there mm-hmm. for aviation. And if you recall, and I'm just say what's been released in the public domain, we lost a F-117 stealth fighter in that conflict. Yep. What you take away from these, I think my point is that what you take away from these different conflicts is going to be different if you're a military guy. And I have had the opportunity to serve in the air and on the ground in Afghanistan. And the experiences vary widely. There's not one thing you take away from all of these conflicts. Each one of them has really different attributes to them. Although it's easy to look at them as a list and go, oh, these are all the conflicts we've been in the past 25 years, 25, 30 years. Mm-hmm. I would just highlight that for an aviator, going up against what we called a Soviet-style integrated air defense system or Soviet-style IADs in an Allied force was significantly different than anything we did in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Out of curiosity, from like a practical, tactical perspective, what makes the IADs different?
I'll just be flippant and say there was one.
Okay. There you go.
What I'd say about it is this was Russian-trained operators mm-hmm. with, at the time, fairly substantial air defense systems. And obviously, both our capabilities and adversary capabilities have evolved significantly since then. But what it tells you is that you really need to be prepared for those. Mm-hmm. And even having a technological advantage in specific areas, like we did, stealth aircraft, precision munitions, GPS, some of the electronic warfare systems, some of the sensing systems, even with all those things available to us, there was still a substantial threat there. And we did take a couple of casualties. Mm-hmm. You might also remember, folks, go back through the press of the time, the subsequently became the chief staff of the Air Force, Fingers Goldfein, mm-hmm. was shot down there as well. We've had substantial conflicts in several domains, is my point,
yeah.
where we had really hard years on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan. But we also know what it looks like to fight a more significant air threat as well.
So I think that contrast is important because from my understanding, most of the conflicts that the U.S. military has been involved in lately, we have air superiority or air dominance, and that there aren't a lot of bad guy planes up in the air that we need to worry about. And then, of course, there's the risk of, you know, ground-to-air weapons, surface-to-air weapons. But still, there's not organizations like, just to pick one, the Taliban don't really have much of an air force. And so we've been able to operate with that air superiority and air dominance. And if we're looking towards the future and the types of countries that the U.S. is competing with nowadays, a lot of them do have fairly sophisticated air forces. How do you see the role of air power, or maybe the experience of being a pilot, changing as we're moving into theaters where, you know, where air dominance or air superiority isn't guaranteed? And I guess maybe to add to that, do you think that the military is doing a good job of preparing for that, or are there things that they could be doing differently?
Let me talk to the second one first. Absolutely. I think the military capability development, joint force, is doing an excellent job of trying to continue to maintain deterrence mm-hmm. against the kinds of adversaries that you're talking about, the ones that can bring a more strategic threat to the United States, ones that can generate air power, ones that can actually push forces forward. I think from a force development perspective, I don't think the nation, the Department of Defense industry has ever taken its eye off the ball as far as that goes. Mm-hmm. I think there's sometimes a misperception that 20 years of Iraq and Afghanistan and counterinsurgency, counterterrorism kind of focus means that we haven't done anything else in other domains. But I'll just give you a couple of examples that remind you, no, we actually have maintained a significant capability mm-hmm. towards near peer adversaries. And just using, again, open source, mm-hmm. There was a recent reporting of a hypersonic Russian missile getting shot down by a Patriot air defense missile. Mm-hmm. This isn't something you just come up with for Ukraine, right? For this kind of forced development has been going on the whole time. Mm-hmm. I would tell you that the kind of air capability that we have generated during this same period, we have nearly 1,000 Joint Strike Fighters, for example, that have been produced, and they've already been involved in operations. That happened during this same period of focus on GWAT, as we called it for so many years. Mm-hmm. So I do think we've done the kinds of things we need to be prepared for near peer competition. The challenge remains, how do we continue to push that deterrence window forward into the future? Mm-hmm. Because our adversaries haven't sat static during that same time. And they have developed different approaches, different capabilities, different operating concepts to minimize our effectiveness. And I think that's an important discussion to have. But I wouldn't buy into the proposition that we've sat still, certainly for the past 20 years.
Yeah, like you said, you got to keep your eye on the ball. And I think that is maybe reassuring to some of our listeners who are worried about the future and issues like this. Now, aerospace is your bread and butter from your time in the Marines and then your time at Lockheed. And I do want to talk about Lockheed in a little bit. But first, I do also want to hit upon sort of the tail end of your career in the Marines. You were the legislative assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is a very cool position to have for our listeners who maybe don't know as much about this. Essentially, the Joint Chiefs of Staff are the top military advisors. So they're all military officers who are advisors to civilian leaders, mostly the president and the secretary of defense. And as a legislative assistant, your job was acting, I imagine, as a bridge between the military world and the civilian world. And we've talked about civil-military relations before on this podcast, but can you talk a little bit about what you were doing in that position and how you were facilitating conversations between those two worlds?
Yeah. So I think there's a tendency to think about the role of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs strictly in his Article 2 role, which you mentioned, as the senior military advisor to the president and secretary of defense. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly, I think, where most people's attention goes right away. But he has a very broad and statutorily mandated responsibility to Congress as well. Like everything else in our government, these positions, the descriptions of them, their exact requirements mm-hmm. are specified by Congress, and going back to Goldwater-Nichols Act. So my role as the legislative assistant to the chairman is to make sure he fulfilled all of his Article 1 responsibilities, not just the Article 2 responsibilities. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that's interesting about that is as soon as you're trying to ensure that the chairman fulfills all of his responsibilities to Congress, which include reporting requirements, but it also includes keeping Congress informed on military matters. It involves testimony, it involves briefs to congressional members, responses to inquiries. When you have to view the military from the congressional perspective, you have to do so at what I would call the strategic level of thinking. Mm-hmm. And when I say strategic level of thinking, what I mean is that you can't wall off any area and say, I'm just an advocate for XYZ. You have to understand the entire political environment, the entire policy environment, the personalities of leadership. You have to understand all these things. But then the role of the chairman is very strictly military advice. Mm-hmm. It's not policy advice. He doesn't say, I think you should do XYZ, Mr. President or Secretary. What he does is he says, this is the policy that the administration is pursuing. If this is the policy, then here are the military mechanisms that would advance that policy. And there are always options in there, which makes it iterative with policy owners. Mm-hmm. But my role there as the legislative assistant is to make sure that he's effective in that environment, considering all of Congress, 535 folks who have strong opinions and oversight.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they certainly do have strong opinions. Was it a weird flip from being a military officer outside the Joint Chiefs to being someone who worked within that framework and the civil military world?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to say that everything prepares you for that point. I don't think that's true. I think there are base attributes that are the same for being successful in anything. You work hard, you make sure that you're prepared for what event is coming up next. There's just anti-level skills, as I call them. But the strategic support strata, I think, is a very different one. Mm-hmm. And I had the privilege of working for a couple strategic-minded leaders before my job working for the chairman. In fact, I worked for the chairman when he was the commandant of the Marine Corps.
Oh, okay.
And I'd worked for a commandant of the Marine Corps before that. So I'd gotten to see some successful strategic thinkers execute their jobs. And again, it is a different set of skills. And not everybody's going to do that.
When people tend to talk about the civil-military relationship, I think a lot of times they tend to focus on the big decision makers, like the Secretary of Defense, obviously the President, the Joint Chiefs. But there's a whole base and foundation of staffers and rank and file people who also work in this space. And can you talk about what they contribute to that relationship as well?
Yeah, Eli, I'm glad you asked about that, because I think one of the things that's underestimated is how much good really capable staff can mm-hmm. do. Not just on issue solving, but making sure that when senior leaders do come together, let's say the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where they're operating in different environments and they're going to come together. And I always described it as these two giant gears are spinning mm-hmm. and they're spinning separated by a veil that they can't see each other. And they're going to have a meeting. This veil is going to drop and these gears are going to hit together. And you really want them spinning as close as possible mm-hmm. to the same rotation. Mm-hmm. And the staff that I found most effective had a couple of attributes. Number one, they were collegial. And I mean collegial, like, you know, from a Senate staffer, Armed Services staffer, calling me up and saying, "Hey, Otter, we should talk about this. My boss is on the warpath about this mm-hmm. issue, and there's going to be a face shot. Let's work through this." So they were collegial. They were honest. They didn't try to manipulate you. They didn't try to advance an agenda. They're interested in the same thing you are, which is, if you're in armed services and then joint staff, you're interested in making sure that we defend our nation, national security. They were trusting of you, so that they trusted you to hold confidences with them, mm-hmm. not just run into your boss and reveal everything that they said, but contextualize it and prepare your boss. And they were trustworthy. If I shared something with them that, "Hey, look, we're not going to be able to move off of this because this is the president's policy, and I would appreciate you not backing us onto a corner on it in the hearing, because we're not going to go ahead and throw the administration under the bus, and we're not going to change our military advice. The military advice is fact-based. It's analytic." And so those are a couple examples. Obviously, you can tell I'm thinking of some specific times in the back of my head, but effective staff had those attributes: collegial, honest, trusting, and trustworthy. Mm-hmm. One other comment I'd make about folks who I thought were most successful, and this includes policy staff in the Pentagon, the ones who realized that their boss's boss, so maybe the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, they have more in common and they view the world from a perspective where they have more in common with one another than they do with their own staff. Mm-hmm. And that's quite often the case. And if your OSD policy staff, the chairman and his staff are not in competition for influencing the boss's decision, it would be fundamentally misunderstanding the roles.
Yeah.
And if you're on the chairman's staff and you're working in the J5 or J8, the policy experts who are working for the secretary are not to be viewed with suspicion. These are folks who are trying their level best to make sure their boss in their specific role is as successful as possible. But the best of them recognize that the chairman and the secretary, or the chairman and the president, or the secretary and the president, often have more commonality in the challenges they're trying to overcome than they do with their own staffs.
And as you were talking about all that, the one thing I kept on thinking about is the importance of trust in a functioning democracy, right? And that the trust needs to go vertically between the big bosses and their staffers that are working beneath them. But it has to go horizontally as well, between people who work in different departments and in different fields, mutually trusting and mutually respecting each other. And it's really hard to make a democratic system work if that trust doesn't exist.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You hit on what I think are two main dimensions of the civil-military relations, particularly in the past six years or mm-hmm. so. And that's the trust between principals. Mm-hmm. So there has to be trust between the principals, but then there has to be a public confidence in the institutional integrity. And I think everyone has to be working towards that, because it's really easy to undo. So if one leg of the institution is trying to undercut another one publicly, you're going to be missing one of those pillars. So both of those things have to exist. I think I have seen very successful trust-based relationships between principals. And I enjoyed a time in the Pentagon when there was high public confidence in the institutional integrity. And I've seen it struggle too, obviously. I think any polling would make clear that that's got some raggedy edges, but it's very doable and it's very important.
Yeah. And that actually brings us to a good spot, because if we're going chronologically through your career, in 2019, you ran for Congress this was North Carolina's 3rd district, which is traditionally, just to give people some background, this is traditionally a very conservative district, and you ran as a Democrat. But how much of this conversation about trust played into your decision to run for Congress?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. So I do refine the characterization there a little bit. I tell folks I ran on the Democratic ticket. Mm-hmm. I didn't run as a Democrat.
Okay.
And no, it's understandable that people make that characterization and assumption. I spent my 29 and a half years in the Marine Corps not registered with a political party. I even through 2017, 18, I did not have a Facebook account. My
smart
job was, yeah, I was very politically aware because I was the legislative assistant to the chairman, mm-hmm. but I was apolitical. When I decided to run, one of the things that drove me to that decision was it had been striking to me that back in 1970 and in the mid 70s, over 70% of Congress had military experience. Mm-hmm. And by the year 2000, less than 20% mm-hmm. had military experience. Now, I don't think necessarily military make any better congressional representatives or senators than anybody else. But during that same period, the what's called the partisan voting index or cross-party voting index, where the number of times that people would cross party lines to vote went in exact inverse to the percentage of veterans in Congress. In mm-hmm. other words, and correlation isn't causation, of course, but there is a direct correlation between the polarization of Congress and the percentage of veterans in there, an inverse correlation. And it was striking to me. I had things that I thought were important. I believed in, like I did on the joint staff and advising the chairman, I believed in evidence-based policies and then evidence-based military recommendations. And I wanted to bring evidence-based representation to my district. Clearly, since you're talking to somebody now working in industry rather than politics, that was not sufficient. Mm-hmm. But I think the foundation of that idea for military folks in particular, they've got that in their DNA. You spend that long in the military, you tend to be very pragmatic and less inclined to political polarization, hopefully, and able to bring sort of an evidence-based approach, I think, to policy and politics.
Why do you think that is? Because I think I agree with that from folks in the military who I've met, that they tend to be, just anecdotally, less politically polarized, especially among officers. Mm-hmm. But do you think that's just because people spend a certain amount of time serving their country, focusing on the goods of the country as a whole, that maybe makes them less polarized? If they go into politics, they're not going to just be focusing on small political wins for their party or for themselves. Is that kind of what you were getting at?
Yeah, look, I think obviously we've got all flavors out there, right? That's... But I do think it's a little bit harder to spend 20 plus years in service of something bigger than yourself and not have that infect your thinking somehow. Mm-hmm. I think it's as simple as that, as foundational as that. It's not a rule by any means. But again, history suggests that there is an inverse correlation between our veteran participation and polarization. And I do think it was one of the my points that I've debated with some of my CICE colleagues in the past, that for folks who have retired from the military, who do have that inclination, they have a responsibility not to get into politics, but to bring that sort of a belief in good, effective institutions to the public discourse. I've seen some great examples of that. Obviously, we tend to get distracted by the folks who take the uniform and then tend to use it poorly, mm-hmm. I think, in the public domain. But there are a lot of folks who, frankly, have been very responsible and I think have helped contribute to the strength of institutions post-service. And I think we should encourage that.
No, and that goes back to what we were saying with trust. It's trust in people, trust in institutions. And the military is, I forget what the recent polling says, but one of, if not the most trusted institution in the United States, still. I find that enlightening. You talked a little bit about the role that retired military folks have in politics, but I think it seems like they also have roles elsewhere in contributing to American security and American defense. And now, to bring things full circle, right now you're working at Lockheed, and you're still contributing to that goal of American defense, and you've spent time in the military, and you've spent time working in the public sector, or working with the public sector, and now you're working in the private sector. And having sat in all those different camps over the course of your career, do you feel like there are threads that tie it all together, that there are skills or maybe goals that you had for yourself, or maybe more for the country, that kind of tie all of that together?
Yeah, I think all of us at some point get into a position where, as we evolve in our career, where we have the realization that, gosh, I wish I'd known then what I know now. And my opportunity here to serve in industry has those moments all the time. I look back on my time in the military, and I'll hone in on one moment that sticks in my head. It was in northern Iraq. We had been fired at by an SA-3 missile site, and it was called an ROE trip, a rules of engagement mm-hmm. trip, which meant that we would employ ordnance in response. And I fired a high-speed anti-radiation missile, AGM-88. When you squeeze the trigger, so you go through your quick combat checks to make sure the proper target data is all right, alignments, make sure the strike package is aware. You squeeze the trigger, and then there's a delay. Mm-hmm. And I won't say the exact time. It's not very long. It's not even in seconds, but there is a delay when you squeeze the trigger. And what's happening is that all the planning that you've done, the data, the refinement of the target package, your aircraft position, all that is being sent to the missile at that point. And it is not a zero time event, and it seems like an eternity. Mm-hmm. But then the one aircraft wing drops as the other one releases the weapon, the rocket fires, and off it goes, and you hear it and feel it and everything but smell it. I think back on that moment now being in industry, and I have a great appreciation for the engineering and technical genius of the U.S. defense industry, because that was 20 years mm-hmm. ago. And the stuff that we're doing now is just eye-watering. And unfortunately, it's by necessity, most of the coolest things are classified. I can look back on that experience and go, it took decades of engineering genius across many disciplines to make that moment happen mm-hmm. and to make it all work. And it is phenomenal. And so I think yes is the answer to your question. I wish I'd known more of that back then, because if I'd been, I think, a little bit more savvy about how hard engineers were working, how hard planners were working in the defense industry, how hard it is to successfully advance defense technologies in an environment, quite frankly, that in the United States is sometimes between wary and outright distrustful. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult job. I didn't know any of that back then. I wish I did. But I'm always struck thinking back to that moment, squeezing the trigger, having that delay, and the technological marvel that was occurring to make all that stuff work.
Mm-hmm. And even on a more basic level, it like flight, human-powered flight, it didn't happen for the first, 300,000 years of human history. And now it does, because of human technological genius. With that, Richard Bue, Otter, thank you again for coming on this show. We hit upon a lot of stuff, all of these different topics, you know, civil-military relations, the defense industry, all of it weaves together into a broader picture of what the American system looks like. And I appreciate you coming on and giving us some insights into that.
Eli, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you again to Otter for coming on the show. And I also want to give a special shout out to the CICE Alumni Network for putting us in touch. Now remember to tune in next week. We will have part two of this interview. And in that episode, we will talk a lot more about Otter's time at Lockheed, as well as the role of the defense industry in American security. Now until then, please, please, please rate and review the show. It really does mean a lot to everyone who works on it. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can feel free to email us at sicestrategypodcast@gmail.com. That again is SAIS, S-A-I-S, strategypodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at SAISStratPod, or on Facebook or Instagram at SAIS Strategy Podcast. This has been Small World, Big Problems. My name is Eli George, and we will see you next week.